China's current ways to censor the internet are to block connections from IP servers serving content and block protocol-level attempts such as Tor at specific points. China is also incredibly aggressive in requesting Apple to do App Store takedowns, which Apple regularly complies with. In 2022, for example, China was responsible for more than 97% of apps taken down by Apple for different countries. And within the country, law enforcement has access to physical surveillance and registered IDs of everybody in China who has purchased a phone, for example. Still, with all of this, and multiple regulatory notices and attempts to ban Bitcoin, China was not able to dent Bitcoin itself, which is humming along at a much better price level and activity level than the level of bans implemented by China. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. This show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to buy Bitcoin, whether you are getting started, whether you just want to learn and understand Bitcoin, or whether you want to get on a Bitcoin standard. Swan has you from start to finish, and for the next $10,000 worth you buy, there are no fees. And this episode is brought to you by CoinKite and the Cold Card Hardware Wallet, keeping your Bitcoin safe. Get a hardware wallet. Don't be stupid. Discount code BitcoinAudible. Details and links right in the show notes. So we've got a read today. This is from Roger Huang, and first-time author on the show. I did not know about this. I don't even remember who put me onto this, but I had this in my list of things to go back and check out. And this is just a really interesting topic to dig into. I feel like nobody has really done the deep dive on what happened with Bitcoin in China and what is its current state, what unfolded, what did it look like, are there any details? And it appears that Roger has written a book about this called Bitcoin and China, Would Mao Have Held Bitcoin, or Would Mao Hold Bitcoin? And this is an article that it's very light. It doesn't like go in any extreme depth to, it just kind of hits the main points, breaks down a lot of the little elements that went through kind of the historical and constant banning of Bitcoin that China went through, the regulatory issues, and then why at a network level, why at a social level, where it was exactly and why Bitcoin continued to thrive and essentially survived that nation-state attack. A very rudimentary, a very kind of like exactly how you would think they would go about it through the regulatory system, through the financial controls, kind of choke point 2.0-esque, banning, mining, all of that stuff. But, you know, what exactly happened? But this was just a good article, and I think we don't, it makes me think about the stuff that I've gone back and looked through, and I don't think we have very in-depth historical analysis of the stuff that's happening in Bitcoin. I mean, we have the Block Size War book, which is phenomenal. But it seems like an area that I think is ripe for content and for self-reflection on exactly the tools that we have available to us and the easiest and best way to use them and where we are falling short. And this is just a really great way to introduce the idea and something that I think having a perspective of what happened in China is just an important thing to cover. It's an important thing to do to kind of self-reflect, look at what succeeded and what failed. And so with that, let's go ahead and just dive into today's article. And it's titled, How Bitcoin Thrived Through China's Bans and Became Much Stronger, by Roger Huang. Many have written about the number of, quote, bans China has implemented on Bitcoin. It was an early joke that China had banned it so many times. How Bitcoin escaped these bans and grew even more vital is a lesson about how to build decentralized technology that is resilient to even the most potent attackers and is a focus of my book on Bitcoin and China. How does China control and censor its internet? China's Great Firewall is based on IP blocking rather than protocol-level traffic blocking. China's current ways to censor the internet are to block connections from IP servers serving content and block protocol-level attempts such as Tor at specific points. China is also incredibly aggressive in requesting Apple to do App Store takedowns, which Apple regularly complies with. In 2022, for example, China was responsible for more than 97% of apps taken down by Apple for different countries. This App Store control represents another attack vector for app-dependent technologies. Apps like Damas, for example, that are only on iOS, faced this attack vector early, with delisting from the Chinese App Store almost immediately after launch. Finally, within the country, law enforcement has access to physical surveillance and registered IDs of everybody in China who has purchased a phone, for example. Still, with all of this, and multiple regulatory notices and attempts to ban Bitcoin, China was not able to dent Bitcoin itself, which is humming along at a much better price level and activity level than the level of bans implemented by China. Vectors for blocking Bitcoin and how each was defeated. Banking communications. China has immense control over the banking system and app ecosystem within China itself. Different conversations on Chinese social media are regularly censored or monitored. One interesting vector for an attack on Bitcoin is that many Chinese social media apps are centralized. For example, Wexin is used disproportionately. There are alternatives like Xiaohongshu and Weibo, but in general, the ecosystem in China is less decentralized for group conversations and feeds. China started its attack on Bitcoin by banning the banking system from holding it, the most straightforward step it could have taken to signal disapproval. However, this gets straight to Bitcoin's utility. Unlike a digital payment rail controlled by a company, like PayPal, that requires a static ID and access to banking to work, Bitcoin does not. In 2013, the first round of restrictions and disapproval from the Chinese party state came when it restricted Chinese banks from using Bitcoin, quote, as a currency. Previously, there seemed to be some openness to allowing people to participate in Bitcoin. The deputy governor of the People's Bank of China and the director of the State Administration of Foreign Exchange has said as much. But with this regulatory notice, China started down a path of bans and made it clear that the banking system was not to use or provide Bitcoin. The next easiest attack vector is to use the Chinese party state's control of communication rails. By banning specific hashtags and key accounts, the Chinese party state has some control over the Chinese internet. It can easily suspend certain key accounts, even particular hashtags and certain language, which China deployed multiple times to stifle Bitcoin. This power is deployed around the Tiananmen Square massacre, June 4th, for example, and has led to multiple cat-and-mouse chases that have led to different ways of describing Tiananmen on the Chinese internet, May 35th, for example. Chinese tech companies have periodically swept through Bitcoin and cryptocurrency influencer accounts, banning them from different platforms. Bitcoin was built to be precisely resistant to these layers of attack. Whether or not Chinese banks hold Bitcoin is irrelevant. For the system's decentralization, it's probably better that they don't. Likewise, Bitcoin will keep pushing blocks regardless of the internet and media activity surrounding it. And there are enough exchanges around the world to make price discovery easy, even if a country takes down its layers of exchanges, as China attempted to do. There is also a broader discourse outside of China, as well as within group chats, that are hard to police completely. Why Bitcoin thrived through this attack? Bitcoin was always built to resist banking system-based attacks. However, the importance of establishing native language ecosystems and rails for onboarding and explanation remains, especially in areas where a central authority controls and censors the internet. Mainland China and simplified Chinese might be among the most significant clusters, but examples abound from Farsi to the Russian language. Any country that controls a large amount of the discussion in one language online can bend the discourse there. Yet it's clear that people are looking for information outside of their countries, and in the case of China specifically, a history of many people jumping the Great Firewall can help people get the documentation they need. GitHub is also surprisingly resilient as a hub, especially for technical documentation. There are 551 results for Bitcoin's Mandarin symbols. As tools for machine learning translation and Nostr evolve more widely, organic efforts to cultivate cross-language communities will likely make Bitcoin even more resilient. This is especially important because local cultural nuances, regulatory nuances, case studies, peer-to-peer discussions, and trade can only happen in each language. Exchange ban. The next layer of attack on Bitcoin is trying to attack central elements of it that cross over into the conventional internet. To have a Bitcoin economy, you need ample trading volume between fiat currencies and Bitcoin. After all, most people still transact in fiat currencies. Bitcoin exchanges are a double-edged sword. Most people will use exchanges to transact, and some will hold Bitcoin there. This helps grow access to Bitcoin among different countries as exchanges serve as rapid on-ramps and off-ramps for fiat. China asked many exchanges that serviced Chinese clients to shut down and went after any foreign exchanges making yuan trades and trying to sell all cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin to Chinese citizens. Why Bitcoin thrived through this attack? By this time, the most popular exchanges were based on altcoin-to-altcoin trade, rather than yuan on-ramps and off-ramps, such as Binance. Exchanges left, but robust peer-to-peer trading economies and OTC trading desks in Hong Kong and mainland China still existed. People went from trading yuan to trading Tether for Bitcoin. Arrests. There have been multiple arrests for trading Bitcoin or USDT, even in peer-to-peer trade. Traders and owners of OTC trading desks have been arrested to make an example to discourage physical trade. However, some persist in doing this trade. For one, it is lucrative, and two, it takes time to catch. People who have been arrested tend to interface with the Chinese banking system. There doesn't appear to be too much sophistication regarding on-chain ties and analytics. Why Bitcoin thrived through this attack. Individual arrests don't matter for the system's inherent incentives. However, Bitcoiners should be aware of nation-state-level threats, especially nation-states that might be more pointed about combining KYC data with individuals. Mining ban. China's advantage in hardware manufacturing quickly made it the hub of Bitcoin mining sophistication, as ASICs and specialized chips became the only way to mine new blocks viably and earn the Bitcoin mining reward. A mining ban quickly disrupted Bitcoin's hash rate as province after province banned Bitcoin mining, which was once a lucrative local tax source after the state council weighed in. One thing is that it doesn't appear that China is using electricity usage tracking to hunt down people with miners, though they are seizing miners in Chinese physical territory. However, it doesn't appear the provinces are overly invested in the ban and enforcement. There have been photos of people selling ASIC miners in Shenzhen and reports of Chinese mining hash power coming back online. Why Bitcoin thrived through this attack. Miners are physically mobile. You can take the devices, plug them in, and run mining. Bitcoin is uniquely positioned to withstand this attack vector because you can move Bitcoin miners across borders easily and set up shop the very next day. Protocol-level bans. China has banned Tor from a protocol level for some years by recognizing entry nodes and sending fake agents that, quote, speak Tor. It has also been alleged that brute force blocking has been used to filter out fully encrypted traffic. It's not illegal to own Bitcoin, though it can be used in China as a currency. In theory, China could do something similar to Bitcoin as it did to Nostr, where it can ban the largest default relays and onboarding flights, making it difficult for people to get on Bitcoin. This has already happened in the application level, where app stores and IP blocks apply to people from China. However, someone can overcome this with a VPN usage, which many people use across China. You can also circumvent this by using your node. As of May 31st, 2024, 55 reachable nodes on Bitcoin use Chinese IP addresses, and as of June 13th, 2024, 49 do. What those nodes are doing is anybody's guess, but it speaks to the fact that people within China still have the ability to run nodes, and that even if the government is running some, that they need to maintain connection to the Bitcoin network even while scorning. Yes, it could be easy for the Chinese party state to ban traffic from reaching the nodes identified and take them offline, and to potentially develop similar pattern recognition to deploy against people sending data in a way that is likely to do with Bitcoin. However, two areas make Bitcoin resilient here. One, there's a global reach of Bitcoin nodes and applications. It's doubtful that nation-states will coordinate all at once to take all nodes offline. So somebody within China can always use a method to broadcast transactions to the Bitcoin network, whether through a foreign app or in a foreign land. Even if China were, quote, cut off from Bitcoin by somehow inspecting every packet related to Bitcoin, a step the Chinese party state hasn't taken, then Bitcoin would still function in the background globally. One could go over the Great Firewall with a VPN or go physically. 2. Bitcoin's scale and its many uses help here too. Unlike Tor, which hides web traffic, someone can use Bitcoin to transmit financial value. For example, more people run Bitcoin nodes than Tor relays, which gives the system more resiliency. And there are a variety of wallets and client apps that can be used to send and receive Bitcoin, whereas there are only a few options to browse using Tor. This isn't to say that Tor is a bad tool or not used, but it is to say that Bitcoin has a unique scale and value proposition that protects it against even the most hardened state adversaries. What happened after the bans, and why Bitcoin is thriving? In the immediate aftermath of the mining ban, the price swayed a bit, but only slightly. The hash rate also decreased, but quickly increased back again from 2022 to 2023. It steadily doubled to highs not seen before the mining ban. Bitcoin quickly took the blow, and people who had mining machines in China moved to different jurisdictions. Bitcoin was fundamentally able to weather the blow of a powerful nation-state because it was built to be resilient and anti-fragile in the first place. Mandarin resources and communities oriented around Bitcoin, whose price discovery mechanism was an investment that could hedge against being stuck in the Chinese system and a store of value superior to Chinese equity and real estate markets. As a result, there were large OTC trading desks and peer-to-peer trading spots beyond the exchanges. Nowadays, the Chinese party state seems focused on Hong Kong's ETF approvals and approved exchanges while shielding the mainland from adoption. There are a few principles Bitcoiners can take from Bitcoin's interaction with China. 1. The more self-custody and diversified from exchanges a Bitcoin economy is, the stronger it is to nation-state attack. 2. Even in extreme cases, the right to Bitcoin ownership can still be preserved. And if that's the case, eventually, a government can move in that direction, though it will prefer using it as a financial tool for its markets. 3. Communication and financial freedom go hand in hand. Having independent media and places where one can express themselves can be a canary in the coal mine as to how one can transact, and the two intersect. This episode is brought to you by CoinKite and the ColdCard hardware wallet. If you woke up tomorrow and the exchange or the service that you use to buy Bitcoin was hacked and everybody lost all their coins, would that destroy you or would that be of largely no consequence? If your phone was stolen and unlocked and somebody went through to empty all of your Bitcoin wallets, how much would that ruin you? If you lost your phone, how much would that ruin you? As many people like to say, they do self-custody and they have really good setups and practices. Most of the people listening to this would probably realize, if they were honest with themselves, that all of those scenarios would hurt a lot worse than they would like them to. And for some people, they would be completely wiped out. This is why you get a cold card. This is why you have a hardware wallet. Right now, I have access to a large amount of Bitcoin on my phone because I work with Bitcoin. My business account is in Bitcoin. Everything that I do is predominantly in Bitcoin, and I move in and out of dollars when I need to. But I use a cold card. I use actually a cold card and tap signer combination of setups with Nunchuck wallet, so the keys are not on the phone. If I lose my phone, I am fine. I can just recover my wallet right from where I am. If my phone is stolen and somebody gets access to it, they cannot do anything without my cold card. If any and all exchanges get hacked, it's fine. I even have automatic withdrawals set up. It goes straight to my cold card as fast as I can possibly get it there. Do not underestimate how great the protection is when you do this very simple step. The cold card is a crazy secure device. You can air gap it from start to finish. You can use it with a mobile wallet using NFC tap, and with the cold card Q, you can now scan with QR codes just using the camera and the larger screen. You have a full QWERTY keyboard, and you can even use it as a password manager. This is the security that the internet has always needed, and we are moving into a future where it is more and more necessary by the day. Get one now while it's still cheap, and before it is the pain of losing Bitcoin that is the thing that finally gets you to pull the trigger. And lucky you, you can get it with the discount code BITCOINAUDIBLE with a link and details that'll be right in the show notes. What I loved about this article, but then also just kind of the idea of really expanding and looking at what happened and why. Not necessarily what happened on the ban side. I mean, obviously, you would need to detail out and know exactly what happened on the banning and legal side, but more what occurred, like, why did this not stop Bitcoin? And to focus on exactly what those pieces of the puzzle are in order to know where our strengths are and to know that we should not be sacrificing those things. And that's something that I think we really, really discount. We take for granted, I think, in a lot of conversation, that Bitcoin just works. And I do not want to lose sight of what an insane improbability that is. And it was in combination, like, a couple of different things that have happened in Bitcoin's past. Like, as I've said before on this show, is I always felt that the China ban was one of the most bullish things that ever happened to Bitcoin. Not necessarily, I mean, yes, because of the decentralization of mining, in the fact that they picked up shop and they went somewhere else. And so it was, I mean, even now, mining as a physical industry, like where it is geographically located, is more distributed across jurisdictions, even though it's more concentrated in the US now than it was, by a long shot. It was still more concentrated in China than it is now concentrated in the US. So in that sense, yes, it was just good for kind of boots on the ground distribution of the Bitcoin ecosystem and the mining, the security industry that has been built around Bitcoin. But really what it was proof of concept. It was, okay, we think Bitcoin could survive this. Okay, we think the nodes can't be cut off. Okay, we think mining would adjust, and there are all of these elements and kind of basic game theory that we can extrapolate on, but none of that really means that it happens that way in practice, you know. And it was the same thing with the block size wars and what the dynamics were between nodes, between miners, between users, between all of these different, between exchanges and developers, like all of these different disparate groups that were all kind of vying for what they wanted. There was a strong game theoretic conversation or game theoretic outcome about the stability and the inertia of the default, of not changing. And it was discussed at length in the open for a very, very long time. That, okay, well, what will happen in this scenario? What happens if the exchanges try to go against the users and the nodes? What happens if the users themselves run nodes that are going to kick off this exchange for listing this altcoin or this fork of the network as Bitcoin? What does that look like? What does that look like in the context of miners? What happens when the network that is broadcasting and distributing blocks and transactions are separate from a network of a couple of top miners that are mining transactions with each other? If they fork, but most of the nodes and most of the users stay over here, how does that play out? How does the distribution of that information across the network play out? And so there were just a lot of moving pieces, and all of it was theory, basically, until everybody played their hand, until the user-activated soft fork forced the situation and forced everyone to make a decision one way or the other. And it showed that the power of the network itself, of simply not breaking the consensus rules, was overwhelming. And that is the core security, that's the core function or core robustness of the Bitcoin system itself, is that for everyone who does nothing, it stays with the consensus rules. And anyone who changes the consensus rules in even the slightest fashion, even when they say, oh, we're just changing one parameter from 1 megabyte to 2 megabyte, it does not matter. If they are breaking the consensus rules, all of the onus is on them to get some sort of consensus, to get infrastructure, to get exchanges, to get miners, to get nodes, to get users, to get wallet software, everybody to move to their client. And if they cannot do that, and enough people, even a strong minority does not trust that, then nothing changes. That was groundbreaking. That is groundbreaking, that we have a system like that. And everything that happened with the China ban and every attempt at closing off the network, even with the difficulty and the scaling limitations of trying to create a peer-to-peer ecosystem with the current set of technology and the current set of tools that we have at our disposal, shows just how important it is, how much that trade-off is dependent on each other. Because peer-to-peer systems won't work, or peer-to-peer ecosystems won't work, if you have big blocks, because you still have to maintain consensus. And that's another thing that was so critical early on, and that the big blockers, quote-unquote, never had an argument for. In fact, many of the people that I had arguments with said that, well, the government's just going to be able to stop it if the government decides to stop it, therefore that entire argument is moot. So there were literally people who were just conceding that argument, that yes, this makes it easier for governments to shut down, but, you know, go ahead. You know, what are you going to do? Government's all powerful, and we can't do anything against that anyway. That was more a BSVer argument. I will say that was more of a Bitcoin Satoshi's vision position than it was a Bitcoin Cash. So I'll at least grant them that. I did not hear that much from the Bitcoin Cash camp. But understanding, just being able to grasp how critically important the entire thing hinges on maintaining consensus and maintaining data connection across the Great Firewall of China, across any jurisdictional shutdown. And this was another thing that we just had on the show in the Block Size Wars Over, if you've listened to the episode with Patrick Smith. And no hate to Patrick, but he even said that, is that, well, we can't possibly, like, if, you know, a totalitarian government decides to shut it down or prevent it from happening, and they lock it out of their country, well, then so be it. Like, it's just not going to happen in that country. And I'm just like, all I can think is that that's the whole point of this thing, is to have it be state-resistant money. If it doesn't work under a tyrant, then it doesn't work at all. Whatever government this becomes inconvenient to means that it doesn't exist in that country. And it's going to be inconvenient to every single government, period. It just is. This is the separation of money and state. If the money and the network cannot be accessible without state permission, it's not going to work. This is why blocks have to stay small. Two reasons. If we can scale by compressing the information, we can also compress the fees. In the sense that any individual who's using it, go back to ARC as the prime example, right? When we talk about seamless, scalable payments, read 829, I believe. I think it was the last one. I'll have the link in the show notes either way if you haven't listened to it. But ARC is a great example of compressing thousands, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of transactions into a single UTXO. Huge groups of people that are all transacting amongst each other and then transacting between other networks over the Lightning Network using a distributed and decentralized payment rails or liquidity rails between all of these various systems, including eCash and Fediment and ARC and channel pools, whatever it is. Well, if everybody pays a 20-cent fee, but you get that a million times, well, that's $200,000 worth of fee pressure to ensure everyone's unilateral exit. Everyone holds the data necessary to exit to the chain. And no matter what you do for capacity, its use will fill it up, period. It will always, Jevons paradox, is whatever size container worth of capability you have for a popular system, a system that is desirable and valuable, we will just figure out how to use up all of the available space. So whether we have gigabyte blocks, or we have 1 megabyte blocks, or 2.3 megabyte blocks, whatever the heck it is now, it doesn't matter. We will find a way to fill it up. A perfect example is that back in 2013, when almost no one was on the network, Satoshi Dice itself, which was a simple gambling service, was doing every single transaction in their little like casino and their random number generators and their tiny little, they had like little, I think, kind of like options contracts, if I'm not mistaken. I might be mixing it up with a different service. And then they had basically slot machines, and they all had one of the really cool things is that they kind of had provable probabilities of just, oh, well, you can know that this is exactly this probability, and this is exactly our cut, which was awesome. But every single one of them created just an incredible amount of dust transactions, of what is now dust. But at the time, blocks were empty. There was very little activity. And Satoshi Dice alone, one service, one popular website, filled the blocks and started pushing up fees. That is Jevons' paradox. If it is cheap to use, people will just use it for anything. If it is valuable and it is free, and arguably a Bitcoin transaction, a confirmed Bitcoin transaction, is of insane value. It is a degree of ownership that you cannot get with any alternative. There is nothing else that can give you the assurance that you own it, you own that value, than a confirmed Bitcoin transaction that's like 6 or 10 blocks deep at least. That is it. That is peak. You own it, and there's nothing anybody else can do about it. Especially when it comes to versatility, global, its global nature, the fact that you can take it anywhere, that you can literally memorize the keys and it exists at any location on planet Earth without anyone else's permission. If that service is free, if there are no fees on the base layer, we are going to find a way to use it up, which means that big blocks are meaningless, not only just in the context of scale, because 100 megabyte blocks don't mean jack when we're talking about global retail consumer peer-to-peer payments necessity. Like, how much throughput are we looking at, really? Just for reference, so you can kind of get an idea of what I'm talking about, is that if we just wanted to match Visa's holiday peak, that's it. So, like, not MasterCard, let's take out PayPal, let's take out Cash App, let's take out any and all of the ocean of other payment alternatives and just look at Visa. If we wanted to match Visa's 50,000 to 70,000 transactions per second during the holiday season on Bitcoin without causing massive, massive fee spikes, we would need 10 gigabyte blocks. Every single block would have to be 10 gigabytes in size. And as someone who just downloaded on his 1 gigabit Ethernet connection, hardwired to a machine that is about $6,000 or $7,000 worth of computation and storage and everything else, I just downloaded like a 4 gigabyte, 5 gigabyte LLM with one of the AI tools that I'm using. And it took like 10 or 15 minutes. Like, that's it. That's the end of nodes. That's the end of decentralization. That's the end of being able to protect against exchanges. And that's just Visa. That is still a drop in the bucket of the retail payments problem. We're talking about the future of payments. We're talking about the future of money and distributed systems for all of this. We are not talking about recreating or just matching the old system. It would be the same thing as trying to scale email by judging how many letters are sent in the mail. That's exactly how many emails we should prepare for. We should always prepare for 100,000x minimum for what the old system does, because we're talking about a completely new architecture with completely new possibilities, which means that 10 gigabyte blocks are a joke. That is not where we're headed. And it unequivocally kills everything about Bitcoin's security and assurances of any kind or sort. There is no peer-to-peer anymore. There is no distributed network. There is no decentralized. There is no run your own node. There is no be sovereign. There is no miners matter at all in security. All of it is gone if consensus is based on the 5 machines in the world that can actually run the whole software. You don't have any historical consistency. Even if all you can do is keep up with the very latest blocks, you have no idea whether your Bitcoin are real. You're suddenly in an Ethereum situation where 70% of the coins just vanished. I mean, just popped up into existence and nobody knows the history. Where the first 100 quote-unquote blocks of Ethereum just don't exist anymore. You're in Bitcoin dark territory where you have no idea where anything originated. And in a couple of years, who knows? Maybe 300,000 Bitcoin just pop out of existence. Just pop into the network. And everybody's confused, and like, well, where did this come from? How did this get valid? And you find out that it's actually a purposeful backdoor that was put in the node software from these 3 major institutions, you know, in defense of democracy or to protect the government or God knows whatever dumb excuse they have to, you know, print themselves money, as every institution that has ever had the capacity to do this does forever and always. It is a given. They will do it, period, end of story. You have something like Bitcoin Dark where it just three years later, just pops out of nowhere and there's nothing you can do about it. Who's got 3 years of history? That's 1.5 petabytes of storage. Just ignore the computation. Ignore confirming any of it or verifying signatures. God knows what kind of cost that would be. It would be like running an AI machine just to actually keep your blockchain in sync with the network. And again, this is at an exaggerated 10 gigabyte blocks in which it still does nothing for retail payments. This is why blocks must remain small, because it has to get across every border. Friendly or unfriendly, or even specifically targeted and malicious borders. And if you can run it through a satellite connection, like a Blockstream satellite, if you can actually sync over low band radio signal, you have a money that is unstoppable. And that always, always must be weighed against the cost and the scaling potential of retail or individual payments. Because all you do as you make it larger is dilute the security. You do not expand the number of people who can have the security. You dilute the security to a greater number of people while putting the entire structure of the system itself at risk. And then the other major consideration is just consensus. If you're forking consensus to even just to get a modest, completely irrelevant change to the scaling dynamics when it comes to individual retail payments. I mean, literally nothing. 2 megabytes, 8 megabyte blocks literally could not be more irrelevant to the scope of the problem that we are talking about. Again, Visa alone is 10 gigabytes. It is layer 2 or nothing. In fact, the more and more I think about this problem, the more I think the SegWit compromise of using a segregated witness in order to fake or get a pseudo block size increase, fake it, it's a real block size increase, but it's just a backward compatible one to 2 megabytes and now up to 4 megabytes when you're just using nothing but signature data. I actually think that was a dumb move. I think it should have been 1 megabyte this whole time. But the best thing we can do now is to just take that as a, okay, maybe that was ill-advised and that was the best we could do to simply solve the horrible contentiousness of the time. And there was simply a break in the social sphere that some sort of conclusion had to arise from. And this was the least of all bad options. And it was the only one that stayed, that actually maintained consensus, essentially making it the only one that had any realistic potential to actually get implemented in the first place. And now we just need to optimize, so that sometime before this decade is out, it will be easier and lower compute and lower cost, finally, to sync a node than it was in 2013 or 2014. But ever since then, on a relative basis, it has continually gotten more expensive. But it should and is likely to turn around finally at some point and start to become cheaper and lower cost to sync those nodes. But another thing that I think was very clear from the start, and I think it just shows that this is the lowest hanging fruit. Like, this is the targeted way. This is how every government is used to having control. Therefore, it makes perfect sense that this is the route they would take, is to attack the financial system or attack it through the financial system. This is, you know, Operation Choke Point. This is the ban in China. Like, everything is about them being able to have control. And the interesting thing about it, and this is something that I actually saw in a translated conversation with foreign leaders in a meeting, I think it was of BRICS nations, at least of the leaders that were there, many of them were BRICS nations, if I'm not mistaken. I know I saw the Chinese, I saw Xi, Putin was there, I believe Saudi Arabia was there. I don't know exactly what international council is meeting here for what reason exactly, but it was a clip of them having a conversation, and it was talking about how the U.S. legal system, the U.S. financial system, and the global financial system in that is run by the U.S. and the European Union, essentially, it is controlled by Western nations, has been used as a weapon, and that a new infrastructure needs to be built that does not rely on this. And I think we cannot discount how powerful that is. Like, that is what we have. We have that. The BRICS nations are trying to adopt that. They are trying to figure out how to make a system that does not rely on the U.S. system, that does not rely on U.S. permission. We have it. We already built one. We've had it since 2009. Just stop for a second. Take a second and think about how crazy this is. We have, in Bitcoin, the single largest globally available permissionless, I mean, technically the only that is permissionless, monetary, financial, and payment network in the world that requires no permission, has no control from Western nations. And funny enough, I am running a piece of that infrastructure right now on a computer that is about 12 feet behind me. My Start9 is running away. I've got the Start9 Pro. That thing is a beast. But I just in general think it's so important not to lose sight of what we've accomplished, and that it's actually really fragile. It's not that Bitcoin is fragile. It's not. But that what we have gotten with Bitcoin is very fragile. We can lose it. In fact, it's crazy that it exists at all. Like, what a psycho shot in the dark. You must be insane to believe this is even possible thing to exist in the first place. And watching it prove itself and then recover and watch half of the mining ecosystem have to shut down and leave a country and then set up shop somewhere else over a period of about 3 to 6 months was just crazy. And the fact that I was using it through all of that time and my interaction with it, my feet, like almost nothing changed. If I had not been, you know, glued to the news and everything that was going on in the Bitcoin space, I would have had no clue that this even happened. It just makes me think when people complain about Bitcoin not being decentralized enough, or they claim that Bitcoin's already captured or all this stuff, or it can't do this. It's like, okay, yeah, like we need to know what it is that we need to solve and the next things that we need to build for. But all I can think is that meme, that Louis C.K. clip of everyone, everything is amazing and nobody is happy. They just act like it's a given that Bitcoin does all of the things that it does, that they're already entitled to all of that shit, even though they don't do anything, even though they probably don't run a node. They probably don't even hold their own keys. They probably have their freaking Bitcoin on an exchange somewhere. They've never developed or built anything for it. They're probably trading a bunch of crypto tokens because they're better, because they got more features or some stupid crap. They don't even understand the point of the monetary system. They don't, the economics of the monetary foundation completely elude them. They do not understand the incredible power of consensus and what Bitcoin has specifically been able to withstand and survive and persist against because of exactly how it works right now. To those people, nobody owes you anything. Quit being entitled little bitches and either help, give useful feedback, or try to build something yourself. Anyway, not trying to get on a high horse here. I haven't even finished any of my projects. I've just been throwing Bitcoin into the ether, hoping, gross, bad word, into the black hole, hoping to have a development project finish out of it. But I also have to say that going back to this article, I think this was a great kind of rough detailing out of the different elements, how China was responding to Bitcoin, and the fact that like things have kind of been walked back, both because of Bitcoin's success and also just because of how ineffective their policies have been, which I think is really awesome to just kind of see, especially in a country like China that has every interest to control and has done so to an absurd degree all of their citizenry, even done physical checkpoints. Like, China is the opposite of anything resembling freedom or decentralization in practically every sense of it from their infrastructure side of things. And unfortunately, the U.S. is headed in their direction very, very fast. But the simple fact that Bitcoin has survived in that environment is something to celebrate. Even if it isn't in the full-fledged concept that we wish it was, and we still have tons of things to fix from the context of sovereignty and holding our own keys and being able to have permissionless, private, truly peer-to-peer payments, permissionless service provision, all of these things. There's still an enormous amount of stuff to build. So don't get me wrong, we're not done. We've barely even started. But I'm going to be digging more into this, and I don't know the author. I did not know the author previously to... He doesn't have his name on the actual article. Where is it? It's on the page. Roger Huang. That's right, Roger Huang. And he wrote the book. The book that this is... I think this is like an introduction to the book, by the way. If I'm categorized... I don't know, but the book is Would Mao Hold Bitcoin? The ChinaBitcoinBook.com. So if you're interested in that, definitely go check it out. I'll have the link in the show notes to both the article and then specifically to the book. But it's really interesting to have somebody who's apparently doing a deep dive on both everything that has happened in China, but then also kind of the perspective on what's going on in China, on the values, kind of the perception from the Chinese market and the Chinese social sphere as to how they see Bitcoin, how they think about Bitcoin. It would just be interesting to get that perspective. And that's something that I've talked about in other contexts, and I really think AI is going to start to break down these barriers where we can actually have live conversations. We can kind of cross the Twitter, the Noster Chinese community, and the Russian community, and the Indian community with the English-speaking people of the world. And suddenly we can actually, the bandwidth for conversation between these different social values and hierarchies and cultures is going to create just an insane amount of change, I think, in the world. Because from kind of the English-speaking world, a lot of that stuff is just kind of a black box. Like, there's just not much crosstalk. So I think it's easy to discount or to minimize how important or how big of a deal it is to have someone with at least a perspective. It's not that, you know, Robert Huang might have the correct perspective or have complete detail on it, but he has a perspective. And just having that information, just having one viewpoint from kind of inside the Great Firewall, so to speak, I think is a really big deal. And there's probably a lot of useful information in the book, or at least I hope there is. Like I said, I haven't read it, but I will have the link and details in the show notes. And I really enjoyed this article. I thought this was a good one hit to kind of reflect on what has happened in the past and what is important about Bitcoin that has protected us during. What if Bitcoin's history can teach us about Bitcoin? And I think China is a huge part of that. What happened in China, if we do not take a sober and clear look at what happened, I think we cannot understand the costs, the trade-offs, the risks of making decisions going forward. So anyway, thank you guys for listening. We will close this one out. Really great read. I will definitely be looking for more stuff from Robert Huang. Roger Huang. And the book, I will let you know as I get a copy of it or whatever and start going through it. You'll undoubtedly hear about it. Speaking of books, actually, if you haven't read anything, I'm kind of on a fiction kick right now just to break myself of the ridiculous amounts of nonfiction I've been reading lately. And if you have never read the Mistborn series and then the Alloy of Law, the Wax and Wane series that follows that, it is an incredibly fun series. And I had just forgotten. It'd been a really long time since I've dug into those books. And I'm reading them again, or actually I'm listening to them again, audiobook, obviously. And they're just fantastic. Super, super fun fantasy. He's built a really crazy world, and the guy's a machine. He writes books like gangbusters. I mean, just kills it. And he has one of the, I mean, this is not true of all of his books. Some of them are a little bit like, I don't like it so much. But Mistborn in particular, a lot of them actually, he does an incredibly good job of this, the author, Brandon Sanderson, does an incredibly good job of writing amazing characters with very identifiable struggles. So the character is clearly the arc that tells the story, and then connecting the world to that character. And then one of my favorite things about his world building, whereas, you know, world building can just be like, it can be dry and pointless and feel like just somebody just wants to build a world and they forgot how to connect it to a character or have it actually be meaningful, and they just want to create interesting ideas. But one of the things that Brandon Sanderson has always done that I just found really, really fascinating and fun to unravel is his magic systems. They're all fantasy, and he creates incredibly well-defined magic systems where there are limits. And there's one, he has a podcast actually called Writing Excuses, and I haven't listened to it in a while, but it's a great podcast. And I believe he said on that show at some point something that I always thought rang so perfectly true, and it can be applied to so many things about how we identify to stuff and how we find intrigue and suspense and are attached to a story at all. And he always said that the most fascinating thing, the most interesting and intriguing thing about your magic system and what will be critical to you to tell a good story will always be where your magic system doesn't work. What are its limitations? Superman is not a story without kryptonite. And I thought that was just a really cool framing. But not to go down a fiction rabbit hole, just recommending that because that's what I'm reading right now. And like I said, I'll be talking about this one when I get to reading this book as well. Bitcoin and China, would Mao hold Bitcoin? All right. Links, details, all the goodies in the show notes. And I will catch you on the next episode. We've got some really fun stuff. I got a really great conversation I had with Johnny, where we really just kind of go down the Austrian and anarchist principle rabbit hole. Like, you guys are really going to love this, I think. And I think it's probably the most complete conversation I've had about arguing for libertarian principles and a libertarian society. And I think I did a pretty good job. Johnny said I did a good job, so I'll trust him. So that is coming very soon. That will be on Wednesday. I believe this is going to be for Monday. So stay tuned. Stay subscribed. Don't forget to check out Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card hardware wallet. This is how you buy your Bitcoin easily and then get it automatically withdrawn to your Cold Card, to your cold storage. Keep your Bitcoin safe. Links, details, goodies, discount codes in the show notes. And with that, I'm out. Thank you guys for listening. I am Guy Swan. This is Bitcoin Audible. And until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. Nowadays, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Oscar Wilde. This has been Bitcoin Audible on the Guy Swan Network.